This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Thank you. Just loud enough, all right? Since you are going to be watching the screen and not me, I'm going to sit down at this computer machine. Okay. You'll also pardon me, but I'm in the last vestiges of a cold, so... Man's weakness for gambling has been exploited by the coin-op industry since its inception. In some ways, gambling was a natural offshoot of the concept of coin-operated amusement, and very early in the growth of the industry, amusement and gambling began to go their separate ways. We'll see how they affected one another over the years. We will see the evolution of the gambling pinball through its three principal stages of realization: pay tables, one balls, and bingos. Then we'll see how gambling features were a part of amusement flipper pinballs for many years. In the pre-electrical days of the early 1930s, some location proprietors would offer prizes or cash to a player achieving a certain score. Of course, this meant manually adding up the scores shown at the holes where the balls had landed. But with wagering at stake now, even at this early date, there had to be some way to detect cheating. The first tilt detectors consisted of a cup at the foot of the playfield. In the center of the cup was a column which projected from the cup and supported a small steel ball. If the game were tilted, the ball fell off the column into the surrounding cup. This didn't stop the game, of course, but it did alert the proprietor that a prize should not be awarded for an otherwise winning score. The idea here is not that the tilt protected the game, because it didn't, but that the score is protected, because now there's more at stake than just the nickel used to play the game. Once electricity was introduced into games, the industry changed. Now that high tech had come to pinball, most of the small companies dropped out. Games appeared that either gave score points or paid cash. These last came to be known as pay tables. Familiar companies producing these games were Bally, Western, Rockola, and Gottlieb. Gottlieb? Yes, they were there with pay tables, consoles, even one balls, which we'll see presently. Of course, Gottlieb would become so anti-gambling, which probably turned out to be helpful to the industry, as regards to the laws and legal restrictions, and promoting the non-gambling aspects. However, in later years, Gottlieb management came to regard their efforts in gambling pinballs the way a family might once have shamefully regarded the black sheep relative. Here is a typical pay table from 1937 called Flying High, made by Western Equipment and Supply Company. About the only thing that would set this game apart from most other pay tables is the theme, which is bird hunting here. By far, the bulk of pay tables had a horse racing theme. Most pay tables have attractive cabinets as befitting the upscale appeal to gamblers. The painted legs were common in the 1930s, but note the wood-finished diamond pattern on the sides and the finishing on the sides and top of the light box. The game presents a solid, formal appearance, and it's usually slightly taller than non-gambling games to discourage children from playing. Many pay tables have a coin escalator, similar to that found on any mechanical slot machine. The escalator displays the last coin played for several plays until it is stepped off the slide into the cash box. The theory is that by showing the coins, shame and fear of exposure will deter a player from using a counterfeit coin. Many times, pay tables dispense checks instead of coins. A check is a substitute for a nickel. The difference between a check and a token is that a token is a special size and not the same as a nickel. Actually, checks were slightly smaller than a nickel, but they would work in a push chute. If the operator wanted to use the checks, he would buy the game with a check separator, which usually added about $10 to the price of the game. The separator was part of the escalator and caused the checks to drop into the payout tube and cause nickels to go into the cash box. Thus, the player could play coins or checks, but the game would only dispense checks. I brought some Bally and Gottlieb checks with me. If you want to see them, just catch me sometime at the in the show and I'll show them to you. The pointer on the tilt indicator is connected to the armature of the tilt relay. The relay is tripped in the usual way and reset by the action of the shuffle when the coin chute is pushed in. The letter J over the ball lift is nothing more than a show of vanity by the company president. It's for Jimmy Johnson, an innovator but a genuine eccentric. The payout drawer on the front is not obvious when closed, a method that's practically universal on these games. Push on one side and the drawer swings out. On the top of the drawer, you can see a small hole. This allows the operator to pin the drawer closed when payouts are illegal or otherwise not desired. Instead, the game can dispense tickets from the slotted plate on the front. Here's a view of the sloped area for the tickets, which were fan-folded. Just in front of the ticket area is the space for the batteries. All early electric games, pay table or otherwise, were built to operate from a pack of batteries, usually 6 volts. It's generally not because locations didn't have electricity. After all, this is the 1930s. It's that most locations didn't have receptacles everywhere handy. Also, high voltage wasn't necessary at the time. The route servicemen were new members of a new industry, and they were unaccustomed to working with dangerous voltages. So there were several reasons why battery operation was desirable. To conserve the batteries, there was a clockwork timer. It was set when the coin chute was pushed in, and after about 5 minutes, it opened its switch and cut power to the whole game. The timer's ticking was usually audible. Also available were DC power supplies called battery eliminators. Of course, this allowed connection to 120 volts. They could be ordered from the game companies or from third-party part suppliers. Here is the motor-driven payout unit and the ticket dispenser on the right. When a coin is played, the ball drops and rolls over a switch in the ball return that causes a wiper to be spun over a disc. The wiper is not stepped, but it's rather pushed, thus giving a random placement. Very primitive, very simple. There were some games made with 7 push chutes, one for each selection, but a single chute, as in this game, became standard, known as the mystery chute. The number and the number of numbers are random according to where the wiper is on the disc. There is just one ball, and it must land in a hole corresponding to a lit number. How much can be won is determined by the rollovers at the top. The minimum number is 10, which means 10 cents, which means 2 coins. The highest win is 200, which is $2. There are no bells, no flashing lights, and the play is fast. Pay tables were quite successful in the 30s, but they're not too common today. Of course, any game from the 1930s isn't common today. But with pay tables, when the law started coming down on this type of game, there was no way to convert it to any other use. The concept of the replay and the unlocking push chute hadn't been invented yet, and there was no score given. Cash or ticket payouts was all it could do, so many pay tables were junked or destroyed. Now we move to the next major development of gambling pinballs, the one ball. Of course, the pay table also had only one ball, but the term one ball came to be used for games having many more features and allowing multiple coin play. The player can put in as much money as he wishes to try to increase the payout odds and buy features that increase winnings or make it easier to win. This is a typical pre-war one ball game. Note the massive cabinet. Actually, the lower half is a separate section which sometimes had the cash payout unit. The two pieces bolted together made a solid, untiltable game. Even so, some operators would put sandbags or chunks of concrete in the base. Because in one balls, there's so much more at stake than in pay tables. More money going in, more money coming out. Some have the coin escalator of the type we saw on the pay table, but this example does not. Note the invariable horse racing theme and the big numbers. Note also the odds. The payouts increase as coins are deposited. Here is a post-war one ball, a Bally Turf Champ from 1950, which makes it a very late model. This cabinet is all one piece, except for the light box, of course. The solid cabinet makes a very heavy and unwieldy game to move, and is still virtually untiltable. This game is an example of a convertible game, which means it can be set to award either replays or cash. This is not a common feature in the later one balls, as they were usually made in separate versions for payout and replays with different names, rather like a two-player and a four-player flipper game. Check the red decorative piece on the top of the light box. That was an old-fashioned feature, even in 1950, one harking back to the decorated light box of the pay table era. Since the machine is so difficult to move for servicing, the bulk of the mechanism is in a drawer, which makes access really quite handy. There are many mechanisms here that would be incorporated in future bingo games. The cash box is enormous, probably the biggest of any game type. I can't imagine a cash box that big being filled up. Looking at the shooter area, there is also hardware that would become standard on bingos. The red ball lift shield, the exposed shooter, and the inverted shooter gauge. Note the wire form covering the runway. It's to prevent ball hopping from the players hammering on the shooter. This provision apparently was never adopted elsewhere in the industry. The strangest feature on many one balls is the skill lane shown here on the playfield. It's really nothing more than a legal dodge. By this time, many laws prohibited gambling pinballs but allowed flipper games. But with one ball set for replays, the only real difference between the two game types was the fact that the gambling games had just the one ball. And so many laws were written to that criterion. Bally's solution to get around this was to add the skill lane. As shown in this game, it's not used. However, to use it, the rebound is removed and four more balls are added to the game. Now, five balls are at the ball lift. The first ball is shot into the skill lane, which is impossible to miss. The next three balls are shot the same way, filling up the skill lane. Under the fourth ball in the skill lane, there is a switch that turns on the play field. The fifth ball cannot enter the skill lane, bounces off the fourth ball, and becomes the ball in play. The laws were thus cleverly circumvented just by adding four useless balls. Rather than a simple win-lose play as on pay tables, one balls have the seven holes repeated in four sections. Starting from the top, they are purse, show, place, and win. As the odds show, the farther down the play field a ball gets, the more a winning hole is worth. There are also other features to play for, and they are arranged in sections selected by the buttons on the front rail. For example, the player presses the horseshoe button and drops a coin, the one that says selection. Now, only the selections and the wild section can change. Along the bottom of the glass is the wild feature. If enough coins are played to step the arrows to the E in purse, it means that all holes in the purse section are winners. The jackpot in the game is the feature race. The pennant must be lit, and then the ball must land in the one feature race hole way down at the bottom of the playfield. This rarely happens, but if it does, this game awards 300 replays or coins. In nickels, that's $16. Even today, that would be a good return on a nickel game. In 1950, it was astronomical. Another common feature is the left and right jockey caps that you see here. In some games, they're trophy cups. But if one is lit and the ball gets into that hole, also at the bottom of the playfield, it gives some major award, but no payout. In this machine, it makes all holes wild on the next game. The jockey caps, you see, are in the horseshoe section. Post-war one balls usually have the ABCD feature. You can see it's the four bumpers at the corners. They must be hit in order, and they come on when hit. In other words, bumper B won't come on until A is hit, and so on. With just one ball and no flippers, it may take weeks of playing before the D bumper is lit. When it is, In this game, it means that the next winner is double, no matter how long it takes or what other features are up. Only when a payout is made is the ABCD unit reset and all bumpers turn off. Regarding those payouts, it may seem absurd to win 20 or 30 or 100 replays, but remember that the player may have put in a dozen coins to buy the various features before shooting the ball. The replay button would be pressed many times for the same purpose. Part of gambling strategy is deciding how many replays to use up now and how many to conserve. Often the replays would be redeemed by the location. For example, the player decides he's finished playing and there are 25 replays showing. The bartender gives him 25 nickels or a prize like a carton of cigarettes. Now those replays must not be played. So he presses a button under the game to reset the replays to zero. Press once, and there's no stopping until the replays are gone. It's the knockoff button, and it probably caused more trouble with the law than any other game feature in any game. Its presence came to be considered prima facie evidence of an intent to gamble, since it had no other use but as a tool for replay redemption. The same problems would dog bingo games for years. Incidentally, the knockoff function operates if the power is interrupted and reconnected. It's part of anti-cheat. This one ball has a terminal block inside that allows a remote switch to be wired in so a bartender could reset the replays without leaving the bar. One balls are great fun to play and require strategy in playing coins because many of the features don't hold. Every coin gives a new set to the selected section. So the strategy is to know when to leave a section alone and play elsewhere. Here is a Gottlieb One Ball. Actually, the Gottlieb One Ball. It's the only post-war model they made. They made one pre-war model called Daily Races, and this one, cleverly named New Daily Races. Actually, it's a pretty good game, and has an interesting feature on the playfield. The center bumper gives the indicated advantages when hit, which probably doesn't happen too often. It's a feature used only on this game. 47 maybe? 47, just post-war. By the late 1940s, the one ball's biggest drawback was its look. With all those pins and flag springs, it really looked old-fashioned, reminiscent of an old pay table. The time was right for a clean break with the past. The bingo game was a new game for a new era, the 1950s. It was post-war modern with its pinball-type cabinet and brightly lighted playfield and replay only. Finally, a gambling game with something other than a vintage horse racing theme, and finally a game with more than one ball. Now the play lasts longer than just a few seconds, which added tremendously to player satisfaction. Bingo themes would tend toward upscale adult entertainment, such as nightclubs, stage shows, and resort life. Also, bingos abandoned the idea of features not holding from one coin to the next. With bingos, anything bought stayed for the duration of the game. The goal in a bingo is to light at least three adjacent numbers. They can be vertical, horizontal, or diagonal. How much is one is shown here. It's like the odds in a one ball, but in bingo, it's called the score. The sets of three numbers are the replays given for a three, four, or five in line. As coins are played before shooting the first ball, the score advances at random. The replays increase rapidly, especially for the five in line. You can see the top numbers are high right at the beginning. Some bingos have a knocker tied to the replay unit. It makes a noisy game, but it does add to the excitement. This bingo is a Bally variety from 1954 and is a typical example. Note the shooter area and recall the one-ball hardware. Every bingo has one player control feature. A few had two, but this game is typical. The feature is called Magic Lines, and it was very popular and used on a few other models. The feature was bought at random by playing multiple coins, and it allows the numbers on the first three columns to be moved up or down by turning knobs on the front rail. Now here are some lit numbers, but no winning in line. See, 10, 19, and that's all you've got. Three numbers in a row minimum are needed to win. Now by moving the third row down, we have a winning row. So it was a very valuable, very powerful tool. Another feature on this game is the super cards. They have to be bought one at a time. The arrows have to be stepped to the right, and on the last arrow, the feature lights. If a three in line is one on a super card, it awards four in line scores. All but the earliest bingos have two rollovers, and what they give varies according to the model. In this case, if the rollover is lit from inserting coins and the ball hits it, number 10 is given. The rollover on the other side spots number 25. Here is the corners feature, one common to most bingos. If this is lit, getting the four corner numbers gives 200 replays outright, independent of regular inline scores. It's the jackpot feature, and it is hard to win. Now remember this corners feature, because we'll refer to it again soon. The player has five balls, and the ball lift is motorized, triggered by a switch on the ball gate. The ball lift is under control of the game because the location of each ball must be known. If a ball gets to the bottom through the return hole, it goes back to the lift, of course, but then it is not counted. With the magic lines, the player has until the fourth ball to set the lines where he wants them. When the fourth ball is shot, the lines lock where they are for the rest of the game. If the first, second, or third ball get to the return hole, that ball is not counted, and the feature stays on for an additional ball. When the player has shot the last ball, he may continue playing by buying more balls. A button on the front is pressed, and coins are played for the extra ball feature. Each of the three words must light up to get the first extra ball. This feature is another reason why there is an electric ball lift. Bingos have a unique characteristic, the continuously running mechanism. No other coin game has this trait. To the inexperienced player, a game standing there with something running might seem out of order and should not be played. There are several design decisions that support continuous running, one of the strongest being in the aiding of randomness of feature selection that occurs with every coin played. Also, with the extra ball feature, there really is no game over. A player could come along and buy extra balls to continue playing the game as he finds it. There is a limit to this continuous running. If the game is not played for about 10 minutes, a timer circuit tilts the game. A tilt is the only time the motors stop. There were bingo games built later that were not continuous running, but that was because of certain features. The circuitry that is most characteristic of the bingo is the search system. There are 25 numbers, but there is not a relay for each number. Instead, there are five search relays, which are very fast-acting. Each number on the playfield activates rivets on a search disc, and the wipers are connected to the search relays. Each number has what can be thought of as a code or a pattern of search relay activations. When there are three numbers in a row, there is one place on that search disc where three search relays pull in at once. That's a win. And at that point, the wiper is seized and held on the winning rivets, and the replays are given. When the payout is finished, the wiper is released to resume running around the disc. Bingos have an interesting coin handling mechanism on the front door. The cash box is quite large, but there is the risk that so many coins going into the game may back up into the coin path. Here is the inside of the door. After the coin passes over the switch, you can see where the nickel is sitting on that ledge. At the end of the coin cycle, a kicker behind the coin kicks the coin to the back of the cash box. The box thus fills from back to front, and there's no risk of coin jam. On all gambling pinballs, the coin lockout is off when there are replays registered. The game will not take money until all the replays are gone. Bingos were originally equipped with bronze balls. They were plated to look like silver, but the bronze was non-magnetic, so that form of cheating was eliminated. The bronze balls look like regular balls, but a close look at one will reveal innumerable flat spots from the softness of the bronze. All bingos and one balls have a control element called reflexing. The concept of reflexing is that the game adjusts how liberal or conservative the features are at any instant. The result is that the more the player has won, the harder it is to get more. This aspect of gambling is vital to their operation. I want to give a simple example of how reflexing works. All right, here is a circuit with a motor-driven wiper. Every time a coin is played, the wiper rotates and stops at random. Then the pulse switch closes, and if the wiper is on the right rivet, the corners feature drops. We saw the corners features before on the bingo back glass. In this case, there are 8 places where the wiper can stop that will trip the corners relay. Now, here is the same circuit with some reflexing inserted. In the right corner is a switch on the feature that lights the left rollover. When that feature is won, it breaks the circuits to one of the rivets on the disc. Now there are only 7 places to win the corners feature. On the left is a wiper and disc that's part of the score unit. For the first 3 steps, nothing happens. But on the 4th step, 2 rivets are disconnected from the corners circuit. So with a good score and the left rollover lit, now there are only 5 out of the 8 places on the disc to win the corners feature. This shows how the features control each other to adjust the odds of the game. There's even a separate reflex unit which responds to the replays won and adjusts the whole game accordingly, even when replays are removed by the knockoff button. As a result, players can be affected by winning games that took place hours ago. The actual reflexing in a game involves both circuitry and mechanical devices. It's clear with all this specialized circuitry and mechanism that one balls and bingos are in a class quite different from flipper games. Bingos especially have some very interesting circuitry. Much of it is dynamic circuitry, which means the features are not locked, such as by the tripping of a bank relay. For example, when an inline is made and the payout starts, if one of the balls be removed from the hole, the payout stops. The search wiper is released, and it's as if the payout never happened. Replace the ball, and the payout continues. Bingos were immediately successful, and Bally, with their principal manufacturer, devised some outstandingly clever features and devices over the years. We saw magic lines and super cards, but there was also magic squares, where the player could rotate the 4 numbers in each corner. A common feature was a knob on the front of the game that allowed players to select one of 4 numbers to be spotted. Some games could increase the number of numbers to select from. There was magic curtain, which made the card get bigger and show duplicate numbers. There was the bump feature, where the player could make the play field jiggle in order to bounce the ball into a hole, and another where the player could kick the balls to the left or to the right within a row. There was magic screen, a very complex system, where the background of the numbers could be moved to put different colored areas around the numbers. There was a game where the player could dump all odd or even holes and reshoot those balls. Bally was certainly at their most prolific in this era. Bingos were really the last word in gambling pinballs. To this day, nothing ever came along to challenge their supremacy as a game type. Flipper games seem so different from these games, and yet the public's desire for big payouts was irresistible to the game manufacturers. Far into the 1950s, many flipper games had jackpot-like features that gave increased amounts of replays. One scheme that comes to mind, of course, is the series of Gottlieb games, which awarded double replays if a second coin were played. The second coin didn't change the odds of winning, of course, but merely caused the replay unit to step 2 steps for each replay won in the usual way. No doubt the law had something to say about this feature. It may not have been true gambling, but it seems mighty dicey. In the flipper games from this era, replays are won from high score or from completing a sequence. However, an extra feature allows replays to be won in such great numbers that they're not expected to be played. Here is a Chicago Coins game from the fall of 1948 called Sally. It's a typical game from the era, with Chicago Coins' post-war modern features, such as the short ball lift on the left and the lighted shooter gauge. There's a rotation sequence of 10 numbers, which means that they must be hit in numerical order for the numbers to go out. As the sequence progresses, the 3 kick holes and the center rollover increase in value. However, once number 6 is hit, the middle hole becomes extra special. Hitting number 6 lights the 1, which means instead of score, one replay is given. Hitting number 7 lights the 2, and so on. With numbers 9 or 10 hit, the replays jump to 10 and 20, respectively. The hole does not reset during the game, so a good player can get dozens of replays. Obviously, this is beyond the expectation of anyone playing these replays. It's clearly a method of providing redeemable games. These games always have a knockoff button on the bottom of the cabinet. Although unlike one balls and bingos, they're not automatic. One push of the button subtracts one replay. Perhaps it was slightly more legal this way, that the subtraction could be controlled and some replays could be left. We have seen that gambling pinballs make up a large component of the industry with many types of games. Several companies got into the act and everyone suffered the constant barrage of laws designed to curb or eliminate this type of game that some people saw as a question of morality. I had a collector tell me one time that he would never collect a bingo because of the perceived damage done to the industry some 40 years ago. Gambling pinballs certainly have the ability to stir emotions. From today's remove, it seems so much ado about little, and the games and their mechanisms do not pass judgment. We see them today, we celebrate their creativity and enjoy them as ingenious artifacts from another era. The universal desire to gamble was well served by our industry, whose products touch countless lives all over the world. I thank you, and are there any questions, remarks, smart cracks? I'll take anything. That would be typical. He says the Gottlieb game, Sweet Adeline. Yeah, that would be the jackpot feature that you're not expected to sit there and play 26 games because it's only one coin per game. So, you know, now you know why they put those kinds of features in. The majority of winnings are going to be like they are today. You get one special, you get one on high score, but once in a while you end up with, bang, 20 replays. Well, you know, you can do with those as you wish, but if you have something going with the bartender, that's between you and him. Anybody else? Older restoration. The Turf Champ is the one I restored recently. That was a great game. I've been looking for a game like that forever. You usually, those big old games like that, they're usually either too expensive or they're a pile of lumber. You know, I wanted something that was fairly restorable. That Gottlieb new daily races, that's not in my collection. I didn't buy that, but I know where it is. I've been trying to find a home for that thing. I don't want it, but I'd sure like to pass it through my shop for a customer. Yeah. Well, I know that the gentleman say he has roll downs in his collection. I'm not sure. Some of those were designed for gambling. I'm not sure. I know there were flipper roll downs. I know that roll downs were, again, just a clever way to get around the law. There were some municipalities that says if the game has a shooter, it's not allowed. L.A. was like that for a long time. And so you had everything else. You had, you know, skee ball and gun games, baseball games, everything else, but no shooters. And a game like that would get around it. Of course, I can't imagine those games would stay very clean. I mean, imagine every player handling the ball every time. Imagine what that must have been like after a while, what the games must have looked like on location. Oh. In a one ball, the balls don't come back. That's a bingo that has their return. Every ball in a one ball goes someplace. In the early days of these console slot machines, again, the law said, well, we can't have games of chance. It has to be a game of skill. So some companies like Evans and stuff, they would put this little baby playfield over on the side. So if you won, you got the ball, you pulled the shooter, it went down, went over a rollover, and you won. You couldn't miss, like the skill lane, but you had to pull the shooter. That made it a game of skill. Again, just got around the law. So I imagine the playfield that you're talking about sounds like it'd be more prominent on the game. And because of gambling, there's a lot of mechanical and electrical things that play into whether it's legal or not, or whether it would fit in this territory, or whether it wouldn't be legal there, you know. So, all righty. Sam. Oh. Excellent. Glad to see there's some people picking these things up. One balls and pay tables, they just seem so old-fashioned and so dull to play to some people. They're not interested in them. One balls, as you see, you know, you have to be a piano mover to get them from here to there. And a lot of people aren't interested in them, and which is kind of sad because they are a lot of fun to play, especially, you know, the later games with more complex features. And, you know, a one ball doesn't play anything like a bingo, and neither of these things play anything like a flipper game, and I certainly think they're worth preserving. No, he asked if we did a one ball at Gottlieb. No, we were going to build a bingo at Gottlieb. That was a golden opportunity, and one of the management asked me if I would be interested in designing a one, because they came to me, because I'm the only one there that knew gambling equipment, and of course I jumped at the chance. He said that there was a possibility that there might be a market for bingos in Mexico. Maybe we ought to, you know, get in on this. This was in the solid state years. So first thing I knew, we weren't going to have any mechanical features. We're not going to sink that kind of money into tooling. We're not going to have magic lines or magic squares or anything like that. Anything that can't be done electrically. We can have extra balls, things that can be done in lights. Extra balls, you know, spotting numbers, and I dreamed up some things like that. First thing I had to do was write a program for searching for in lines, because our system wasn't set up for that at all. And I had some help from John Burris, and we did get software written, and I started laying out a play field, and I had a number selector knob. It looks like an old channel selector on an old TV, and we were going to copy that. We were going to make that. And I never got to the point of drilling a play field. I had paperwork, and then management called me in and said, there's no way. There's just too many legalities that just, we could never even get it out the door. So the project was dropped. But it was fun for a few weeks. Yeah. Yes, sir.
What year was that?
Oh, boy. Solid state? 81? Something like that?
So you were on system 80?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The original system, you know, we kind of whizzed through that as quickly as possible, because that really just, that was like working without thumbs, you know, that first system. But the system 80 gave us some real flexibility. Yeah, yeah. Well, and for programming, they program the same way. It's just that in the original system, there just wasn't enough space. You know, you'd program a game, and you're out of space. You just can't do the cute features that you want to do. There just isn't enough room. When they went to System 80, they doubled the capacity. That's what it was, literally. It was a doubling of the capacity for programming. But it was the same language. Okay, that it then? Well, thank you very much for your kind attention.